Domestically, the year 1956 has been a good year, a prosperous year. Our people were fully employed. Our national income was at a record high. It was a good year. The farmer did not fare as well as the rest of the population, but measures have been taken by our government to improve his financial position. Through soil bank arrangements and in other ways to raise the farm income. There was some inflation which reduced the purchasing power of the dollar. But economists tell us that it was not a runaway inflation. And our government made efforts to check inflation through the tightening of credits and through other ways. ...1956 was a national election year. And we were treated, of course, to considerable and quite traditional and customary electioneering ballyhoo. There being no sharp political issues at stake, and as a result of prevailing good times, there being no great discontent among our people, the administration in office was reelected. President Eisenhower was reelected by an overwhelming majority. The Republican Party, however, did not win a majority in Congress. This is rather unusual in a presidential campaign year. Evidently, the president was far more popular than his party, and the American people trusted the president far more than his party. This imposes an even greater measure of personal responsibility upon President Eisenhower. What it is to him rather than to his party, and to the leaders of the party, that the American people will look for the attainment of those objectives, domestic and international, which it seeks. The year 1956 saw definite progress in the direction of school integration and the abolition of Negro segregation in the schools of the South and in other areas, such as transportation. As might well have been foreseen, the process of integration has been attended by considerable resistance, on occasions flaring up into violence. Race antagonisms die very hard. The habits of generations are not easily changed. There are diehards, that are demagogues. And these will not yield easily. But when the cause is fundamentally right, and government declares it to be right, and is resolved to back it up by all the agencies at its disposal, even if it does not actually resort to coercion, that cause is bound to triumph in the end. The unanimous decision of the Supreme Court of the United States on school integration opened doors upon a new era of racial progress in our land, which will never again be closed. Far less progress was recorded in 1956 on the international scene. No new gains were registered for international cooperation or for world peace. North Africa, Cyprus, continued to erupt in fierce resistance and bloody underground activities. The Middle East was the scene of war and battle, as well as of violent political agitation. Hungary was the scene of a heroic, desperate revolution, and also witnessed a most brutal and tragic suppression of that revolution. There was unrest, and there were riots in Poland, Eastern Germany, and elsewhere. The Cold War, which abated somewhat after the death of Stalin, and as a result of the conciliatory olive branch postures of Khrushchev, Bulganin, was again in full force in 1956. The world was as sharply divided as ever. Here and there through the year, one heard talk about disarmament, but nothing materialized. And more often one heard of new and increasingly deadlier weapons being fashioned for a war which everyone dreads, the possibility of which everyone denies, but for which nevertheless everyone is feverishly preparing. Proposals for disarmament emanating from either side, from the East or from the West, are at once met by the cold blast of suspicion and the die of warning. No statesman of superior vision, courage, and authority to point out a new way appeared on the scene in 1956. Eden, Mole, Dulles suffered sharp diminution in their prestige as a result of the Egyptian fiasco, and Khrushchev and Bulganin came out of the bloodbath of Hungary, smeared and discredited. President Eisenhower does not appear to have been as dynamic and forceful in the pursuit of peace, which is so close to his heart, in 56, as he was at the summit conference in Geneva in 55, when in response to his confident statesmanship, the whole world turned to him in high hope and anticipation. President Eisenhower, I believe, if he will finally take the reins of our foreign policy into his own hands, may yet emerge as the leader of a new age, guiding the nations of the world along a new road to justice, reconciliation, and peace. To substitute, using his own words spoken at high moments at Geneva, to substitute cooperation in human welfare for competition in the means of destruction. The year 56 was not a good year for the United Nations. In spite of a display of great activity, and an increase in apparent authority, the United Nations was unable to stop the sporadic infiltrations and murderous attacks on the Israeli borders, which finally erupted in the military action of last October. The year 56 climaxed 8 years of hesitant and ineffective action, or lack of action, in meeting the mounting crises in that region and in establishing Arab-Israeli peace there. The United Nations was unable to persuade Nasser, the dictator of Egypt, to open the Suez Canal and Aqaba for Israeli shipping. It did not invoke any sanctions against him, and thus serving notice that the decisions of the United Nations may be ignored with impunity. When this same Nasser seized the Suez Canal in violation of a 90-year-old international treaty, the United Nations did nothing. It was not permitted to do anything. England, France, and the United States decided to handle the situation themselves outside the framework of the United Nations. And only after these nations became convinced that they could not by themselves do anything about it, since they could not agree among themselves on procedure and on method, only then did they turn to the United Nations. And when England and France became convinced that their very vital interests, their life interests, in that canal would not be protected in the United Nations, and that the issues which had by then been dragged through a long series of conferences and negotiations would be talked to death in the United Nations, they resorted to military action, which coincided with Israeli military advance into the Sinai Peninsula as a result of what President Eisenhower called grave and repeated provocation. And because the United States resented sharply this action on the part of Great Britain and France and Israel, and was determined to give vent to it in the United Nations, suddenly the United Nations was permitted to come to life. And a ceasefire and withdrawal resolution was quickly adopted. The Soviet bloc and the Afro-Asian Arab bloc, of course, enthusiastically joining in that resolution. Now, there has been, and I'm sure there will continue to be, a sharp division of opinion among people everywhere as to the wisdom of this action, which was taken in the United Nations. I personally have on several occasions, both from this pulpit and on the air, stated my own opinion. But the point to bear in mind when we discuss the prestige of the United Nations is that its ceasefire resolution was complied with only because the three countries against whom it was directed were free democracies, free democratic countries, responsive to public opinion, responsive to international opinion, and to moral suasion. Were the same resolution directed, say, against the Soviet bloc, or the Arab bloc, or any dictatorship, it would have been unceremoniously ignored. And this fact, of course, was quickly demonstrated, almost simultaneously demonstrated, in the case of the resolution which was adopted by the same body, almost at the same time, against Hungary. The United Nations requested that Hungary permit some on-the-spot observers from the United Nations to enter Hungary to see for themselves what was taking place, to report back. It also called upon the Soviet to withdraw its troops from Hungary. This was as thoroughgoing a resolution as the one, the ceasefire resolution, which was adopted against Great Britain, France, and Israel. But this resolution was rejected out of hand, and nothing has been done about it by the United Nations. No sanctions applied. And even observers which were to have been sent to the neighboring countries of Hungary, to Austria, to receive reports from the refugees pouring into Austria from Hungary, even these observers have not been dispatched. In fact, it is important to bear in mind that the same Arab bloc which so loudly denounced Israel and the colonial aggression of Great Britain and France, it thundered against aggression, clamored for the protection of national sovereignty, and shed bitter tears on what was happening in the Sinai Peninsula. The same bloc, the Arab bloc, abstained from voting when it came to condemn Russia for violent aggression and the bloody suppression in Hungary. And even India, whose leader Nehru recently visited the United States, and who speaks so often and so righteously about international morality and the rights of people, great and small, even India abstained from the vote of censure of the Soviet Union. It is therefore my belief that the UN ceasefire resolution did not enhance the prestige of the United Nations, but it pointed up a very grave and very dangerous double standard on which it seems doomed to operate, and one which I am afraid will ultimately destroy the United Nations. It is helpless to act against aggressor nations, members of the UN, who are insensitive to moral pressure, such as Egypt was in the case of the Suez Canal, or feel themselves strong enough, like the Soviet Union, to defy the UN or to ignore it. And this in time will, of course, make of the United Nations exclusively an instrumentality to be used only against the democracies of the West and to be exploited by all the enemies of the West. And when this fact becomes established, when the UN can no longer dispense even-handed justice, the UN will disintegrate. What we have seen, therefore, is not a sign of growing strength of the United Nations, which we all hope for, but a dangerous warning of what might happen to that international body. The year 1956 has not been a good year for American diplomacy. Our precipitate and drastic intervention in the Suez affair hurt and offended and lowered the status and the prestige of our two most important, loyal, and dependable allies. Which clearly is not to our advantage and could not have been our sober intention. And that's exactly what happened, though. The Western Democratic Front, the Atlantic Alliance, has been hurt and weakened. And we've begun to realize it. In fact, we began to realize it almost immediately after, in our hot tempers, we pushed through that resolution in the United Nations. We are now making serious efforts to repair the damage. We've come to confess, but we never should have forgotten, that what took place at the Suez was not entirely without our fault. And the action of our friends is not entirely without provocation. What we have gained in the Asian-African world as a result of what we would like to believe was high-minded action on our part will, I am afraid, not pay off. The Arab governments praise us now because we led in an action which was clearly to their advantage. Their praise will turn again to violent condemnation as soon as we suggest anything of which they disapprove. It was just a few months ago, you will recall, that this same Nasser told the American government and the American people to go choke on their fury when he sees the Suez Canal. And it was not so long ago that the entire Arab press was denouncing the United States as imperialistic, guilty of falsehood, deceit, and ill will. Now, it was not, of course, our intention to restore the little Hitler of the Nile, Colonel Nasser, to his power and prestige, or certainly not to augment him after he had suffered such a disastrous and ignominious defeat at the hands of the Israeli army in the Sinai Peninsula. No, it was not our intention to put him back on the throne. But that is exactly what our diplomacy achieved. Nasser is now sitting on the top of the world and is dictating to the United Nations, to the whole world. And I'm afraid that when all the excitement will have calmed down, Colonel Nasser will be found to be in complete control of the Suez Canal, and the so-called six principles, which were adopted some time ago by the Security Council, to which Egypt agreed, will be no more than a scrap of paper. And the lesson will not long escape those Arab governments which have Western oil concessions and installations in their territory. This same Nasser has been following the traditional line of Hitler in the persecution and the deportation and the expropriation of Egyptian Jews, concerning which the world does not seem to have been so upset, or our government for that matter, as it was about the Hungarian refugees. Thousands of Jews who are Egyptian citizens have been called to local police stations, and they have been informed that their citizenship is canceled and that they must leave the country without delay. Citizens or nationals of other countries, including Canadian, Greek, Belgian, French, and British, if they are Jewish, have been singled out and ordered to leave the country within 7 days. Stateless Jews, including natives of Egypt, have been ordered to leave the country, although they have no other allegiance and no nation to whom they can turn for protection. In the case of thousands of these, as in the case of many who are citizens, their forebears have been in Egypt for centuries. Jews who are forced to leave, regardless of homes, property, or investments, are permitted to take with them only one suitcase and 20 Egyptian pounds. The property, firms, corporations, and banks owned by Egyptian Jews have been expropriated. The value of Jewish property in Egypt is estimated at $450 million. An economic boycott is being organized so that remaining Jews cannot continue to support themselves or work in Egypt. Concentration camps have been set up for Jews that include one prison, the Citadel, one camp, and two schools. There are reports that at least one member of each family expelled is held as hostage for the action or statement made by those who are forced to leave the country. It was surely not the intention of our diplomacy to increase Soviet power, influence in the Middle East. But this is exactly what has happened. It was the Russian threat of military intervention, the sending of so-called volunteers, heavy arms, which the Arabs are persuaded, forced France and Great Britain to abandon their military intervention. Russian prestige at the moment is very high, not only in Egypt, but in Syria and in Jordan. The Russian penetration of the Middle East is, in my judgment, the greatest single defeat of our diplomacy in recent years. and the clearest proof of the calamitous weakness of our foreign policy in that part of the world. Our government is now seeking to counteract Soviet influence, judging by the reports in the press, by large-scale economic and military aid to the peoples in that region, and by giving President Eisenhower standby authority to use American force in the Middle East, if necessary. The same kind of authority which has been given him by Congress in the case of Formosa. In this connection, however, it should be borne in mind that you cannot protect a region against infiltration by communists if member states in that region would welcome that kind of infiltration, or are not opposed to it, or use the threat of a possible infiltration to wrest concessions from the nation that is attempting to protect them. And it should further be borne in mind that the peace of that region cannot be protected against foreign aggression or invasion when there is no peace within that region, and when member states within that region are not only politically at odds with one another, but are seeking to destroy and obliterate an important member nation within that region. Fortunately, the year 1956 was not a good year either for dictatorship. The events in Hungary, whichever way you look at them, point clearly to a sharp decline in the strength and in the solidarity of communist dictatorship. People don't want it. And given the slightest opportunity to express themselves freely, they give clear evidence that they don't want it. This is the meaning of the widespread unrest in all the satellite countries, regardless of the degree of that unrest at the moment. In Poland, the day was saved for Moscow-dominated international communism by vast concessions made to Gomulka and to the Poles in terms of their national sovereignty and their independence as far as the internal affairs of Poland are concerned, and the promise to remove Russian troops at the earliest opportunity. This for a time delayed the people's resentment against communism itself. But this will come and is bound to come in time. In Hungary, people were not satisfied merely with an autonomous, sovereign, communist state. They demanded a coalition government, an end to the one-party dictatorship. They wanted freedom of expression, the rights of free men. And so great was that demand. Thousands of Russian tanks and tens of thousands of Russian troops had to be imported by the puppet regime of Hungary to crush the revolution. And 145,000 Hungarians have had to flee the country. And many, many more would like to. It is clear that the strength of communism, the crusading strength of communism, is at an end. And that the strength of communism no longer lies in the appeal of its ideas, its ideals, its ideology, which captivated the minds of many people, especially of the young, in many parts of the world, But it is today a barefaced dictatorship, compelled to resort to the methods by which such a dictatorship in all history could maintain itself in power, namely terror and the might of arms. And there is no future for this kind of despotism. And the youth, especially the youth of the universities, all through these satellite countries, and even within the Soviet Union itself, has become restive. Communism has lost its glamour for them. Freedom is again for them the holy grail which the youth of the world is seeking. But this does not mean that the Soviet Union is about to fold up this year or next year. And it does not mean that we will not have to find ways of living together in the same world with the Soviet bloc for an indefinite period of time. It does mean that communism is being steadily exposed, its weaknesses, its inherent spiritual corruption, is becoming crystal clear even to the eyes of those who for years have been indoctrinated by it. The seed of destruction is within it. What of 1957, good friend? 56 is gone beyond recall. 57 is a year in which men and nations will have an opportunity again to try to achieve that which is so vital to their well-being. Our own country can do much in that direction, though not everything. 1957 may be a good year for mankind if a true and consistent national policy emerges here, a policy really concerned with undergirding the threatened structure of the free world, and which will help especially those nations, large and small, whose traditions are the traditions of freedom, and whose way of life, or whose hopes and ideals, are bound up with the future of a free society. If ever there was need for an agonizing reappraisal of our foreign policy, it is now. For a long, crucial lines, our policy has disastrously failed. If we are going to make the United Nations, as we said we would, the principal channel through which international problems are to pass and solutions found for them within this international body, then we must be wholehearted about it and see to it that all major problems are placed before the United Nations, and to see to it that the free forces are united in finding the solutions which free peoples would like to find for these problems, and in seeing to it that these solutions are enforced by all the means defined in the Charter of the United Nations. Enforced does not always mean war. One of the disastrous things our foreign policy has been guilty of is to announce at the very outset, when we entered serious discussions with other powers, that we will never use force. We did that in the case of the Suez Canal. That was the end of it. NASA, realizing that we had no intention to use force, laughed at every other proposal that was put before him. We cannot, on the one hand, say that the United Nations will now be charged with the responsibility of solving international problems, and on the other hand, say that in certain parts of the world, we will act alone, not even consult our allies. This inner contradiction has stultified and will continue to stultify our leadership in the world. As far as the immediate problem in which so many of us are concerned, I think it would be the part of great political wisdom on the part of our country not to adopt and not to permit any settlement of the Near East problems which excludes or ignores or bypasses Israel. Such settlements cannot last. Open the Suez Canal and still permit Nasser to blockade that canal against Israel is simply to put the problem back where it was before the military outbreak. To insist merely on a return to the status quo before October last is solving nothing, but is preparing the ground for an even bloodier settlement. The United Nations force, which has been sent into that area, should remain there until permanent peace, settlements, and arrangements have been reached. It should not leave that area for Nasser to move back and to begin, as he already seems to have begun, his Fedayeen raids across Israeli borders. Nasser should not be permitted to return to the Gaza Strip. That is not Egyptian territory. That will provoke conflict upon conflict. It would be the act of wisest statesmanship to ask the young state of Israel to take over that Gaza Strip as a means of settling the core of the Arab refugee problem. There are some 250,000 or 300,000 Arab refugees which have been kept there by Nasser in unspeakable conditions of misery and poverty. Israel should be asked to take over that problem with whatever help the world can give it, and endeavor to resettle the Arabs upon that land, and ultimately incorporate those Arabs as full-fledged citizens of the State of Israel. This will mean a terrific burden upon the young state, political, in absorbing such a large non-Jewish element, some 30% of the population, Jewish population, including the Arabs in Galilee. It will impose a tremendous economic burden upon the state of Israel, because Israel cannot tolerate two standards of living for Israeli and for Arabs. It will have quickly to raise the standard of living of these utterly impoverished and exploited Arab people. It will go a long way to solving the whole Arab refugee problem, because this is the core of that problem right there in Gaza. Whether in 57, American statesmanship and world statesmanship will rise above considerations of oil and momentary expediency and power politics, and will really reach out for the kind of solution which will give peace to that region, and ultimately a degree of prosperity which will help the Israeli and the Arabs to live together and work together for the improvement of that whole region for the benefit of all. Whether 57 will be the blessed year which will make that possible and remove one of the sore spots of the international scene, one of the power kegs, that remains to be seen. Surely there's a great searching of heart going on now as a result of what happened in recent months. Perhaps some real good will emerge. At least that is our hope and prayer for the coming year.